Well, a couple of years ago, we began this tradition that we're going to continue this afternoon, which is that we have not only what we've already done, some announcements and some practice for our chapel, and thank you for doing that, but also a very brief lecture. Now, when I say very brief, I want to make it clear that at 4:30, even if I'm only in the first point, we stop. But I will not. I do not have a long talk to give to you today. At least I don't think it is. I've never given it before, so we'll see. But at any rate, I want to begin by asking you to turn to some of the sheets that you picked up as you came in this afternoon, because this is really not the first two things that I'm going to do are not part of the talk, but we'll just make them part of the talk. The first thing that I want you to look at is a sheet titled How to Read an Academic Book. I've talked about this before here, but I don't think that I've ever actually given this out. Have I? Does anybody remember receiving this in the past? I've always threatened to give it out to everybody, but I don't think that I ever have. Let me give you a little background as to how this came to pass. As you know, I teach at Northern Seminary. And when I began teaching there, I was told that every course was not allowed to exceed in its reading more than 1,000 pages for a three-hour course. Now, I'd been at Wheaton where it was my custom to ask students in a four-hour course to read 4,000 pages of material, and they actually did it. And so when I arrived at Northern and I could only ask people to read 1,000 pages, I just really felt like my hands were tied behind my back. And so I decided after a couple of semesters that, phooey on this. So I didn't tell anybody about it. What I did is I just assigned approximately 3,000 or 4,000 pages of material that students should become acquainted with in that particular course. And then I sat back and I thought to myself, maybe I ought to tell them how I read an academic book. And I did. I wrote this, and it's sort of circulated among Northern students, and I want it to circulate among you because you have a lot of reading requirements, as I note in your syllabi. Not enough, but it's a good start. I mean, we should double it. We faculty members, if you'll keep that in mind. But at the very top of this page, do not read an academic book word for word, page for page, chapter for chapter, unless I wrote it. Now, do read a book. I'm not going to walk through this whole thing. It would take too much time. I'm going to let you read it. Read a book like you would look at a picture. Study its frames, and finally examine its details. And here's how to do that. And all I'll do is just walk through these large, bold numbers. First, get the big picture in sight, and then I tell you how to do that. Second, frame the book, and I make some suggestions on that. Third, continue to look at the frame of the book, looking now for the structure of the book, because every book has a structure. And then fourth, you're now ready to analyze the book in detail, and I suggest how you should do that. And fifth, if this book is worthwhile, and all the books that we would suggest that you read are definitely worthwhile, then outline and memorize the contents of the book, and this will reshape your understanding in ministry. For you have created a framework for building a house of knowledge. Excuse the introduction of another metaphor. The next book you read on the same subject will bring a room together, maybe furnish it, maybe even force you to move the furniture out and bring the new in, or perhaps rebuild the house, and on it goes. So if you will take this and spend a little time thinking about it, it will not only save you a great deal of time, but I think it will give you a guideline on how to read an academic book quickly. You should be able to read a 500-page book in about 3 hours. Or five. Okay, done with that. Whoops. Okay. Okay. The second thing that I want to talk to you about is some help. It's kind of like help. I need you to help me with something here. And that's in the second sheet that you'll see. Can you hear me? I'm trying to fix this thing. I think I'm getting it. There it goes. I am creating, and this is on the to the IWS community, creating a four-week journey to help the local congregation focus on worship renewal. And I need to find a title that will elicit a response. So I'm asking you to help me. So there are a few titles that have come to mind, and I'm going to ask you to just simply mark the one that strikes you the most, and the one that suggests this would be helpful to my congregation. Now, if you have a pen, I'm going to actually ask you not to think about it, but to just simply do it right now, and then pass it in to me when I'm finished with my lecture. Just take a minute to read through them. Rediscovering the Joy of Worship, A Four-Week Journey for the Local Church. Together, Rediscovering Community and Worship, A Four-Week Journey for the Local Church. Convergence, Achieving Substance and Relevance in Worship. Renew Your Worship, A Four-Week Journey. Emerging Worship, Old Ways in a New World, A Four-Week Journey for the Local Church, or something else. What strikes you as, I'd be interested in that? This is a form of research, by the way, that you can use to write any of your papers, sanctioned by Gary. Okay, if you're done, just pass them into the middle, and thank you very much for doing that for me. And whoever's on the end can just at the end bring it up here. Be fine. Or, yeah, you can collect them. That'd be good. Go ahead and collect them. Okay, while they're collecting them, let me say that it has been our tradition to choose a book. I get to choose the book. And I normally choose a book and then give a lecture on it. With the publication of this new book by Reggie Kidd, you've received information about this, I decided that I would not try to lecture on Reggie Kidd's book. So Reggie will be speaking tonight. Am I right about that? Uh-huh. And for how long? 10 minutes? We usually... Okay, at least 10 minutes. But you have read Reggie's excellent new book, and Reggie will speak on that tonight. So I'm going to talk about something else. And it's titled The President's Lecture, January 2006. But let me give you a little background to what we're going to do today. Let me begin with a little historical background. I think most of you know that when I think about history over the last 50 or 60 years, I always think in terms of the cycles of history that have been presented by Strauss and Howe in their book titled The Fourth Turning. Now, in The Fourth Turning, they suggest that every fourth turning is a turning back to something previous. And the way in which they understand history is that history moves from crisis to stability to revolution to unraveling, and then back to crisis again. Now, if you keep that cycle in mind, they claim that they can go back into an American history and demonstrate how American history every 80 years or so goes through that cycle. And in their book, The Fourth Turning, they have suggested that we have recently gone through that cycle and that we're ready to begin a new cycle of crisis. Let me put that into historical perspective. The first crisis that we're thinking about in the past for us would be the crisis of World War II. Out of that crisis, we came into a period of stability in the 1950s. Now, most of you are way too young to remember the 50s, but there are a few of us here, Jerry and myself, perhaps, being the two prime persons, maybe Doris, who remember the 50s. And the 50s was a time of strong stability, institutions, institutional values, Christian presence in this country. The 1960s were a period of revolution. I can remember where I was when President Kennedy was shot, when his brother Robert was shot, when Martin Luther King was shot. I can remember the upheaval of the 1960s and all of us asking the question, what's going on? The period of the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s can be seen as the period of the unraveling of that revolution that was begun in the 1960s. And all of us have been very aware of the unraveling of our culture, of our Christian values, of our Christian perspective, of the rise of secularism, the rise of the New Age, the rise of narcissism, the rise of a new culture. Now, the argument of Strauss and Howe is that around the turn of the century, now this was written, I think, in 1997, their book called The Fourth Turning, around the beginning of the third millennium, there would be a new crisis. And I identify that crisis as the crisis of the emergence of a postmodern philosophy and postmodern culture and the emergence of a new world war, the war on terrorism. As I have been reflecting on the changes that are taking place and the fact that in our churches we now minister in a sense in two worlds, because in many of our churches there are lots of people who are still of a modern mindset, and we have to minister to them. But in our churches, the young in particular are moving much more toward a postmodern mindset, and we need to minister to them. And if you have been reading anything about the emerging church and the changes that are taking place theologically, you know that there is a great cry for some kind of clarity about where we're moving theologically. Many people who have embraced the understanding that they live in a postmodern world are accused of moving away from the sort of the historic evangelical sensibilities. And some people are saying, you know, don't move into a postmodern way of thinking, because postmodern way of thinking is a slippery slope into a liberal persuasion about reality. Well, at any rate, as I've been thinking about that, I've been asking myself the question, what does a theology look like in the context of a postmodern world? How do we remain rooted in historic Christian faith? What is it about the modern world that we need to deconstruct? And in deconstructing modernity, where do we move theologically within the context of a postmodern world? And then most especially important for this community is how then, if we move into a postmodern world and begin to minister in a postmodern world, how then does that impact our worship? And so, probably about a month ago, I began to convene a group of people, a group of scholars in particular. Actually, there are about 250 scholars that have joined this venture. And we're calling it A Call to an Ancient Evangelical Future. And this is all in process. None of this is complete. But what I want to do is to introduce to you the call and talk a little bit about that call to give you a sense of the shift into postmodernity, because I think most of us here feel that that's a welcome shift and that there are many new opportunities for the Christian faith within the context of a postmodern world, so we're not afraid of postmodernity. But I do think that we have to think deeply and clearly about how we remain historic within the context of a postmodern world. So I want to read for you this call, which introduces us to 39 articles. Now, I don't know that it's going to end up being 39. I kind of did some wishful thinking that it would be 39, so I wrote out 39 things here. Because I like 39, you know, 39 articles. It's the Anglican tradition within me. But at any rate, I'm going to read this call, and then I'm going to come back and make some comments about some strategic issues that are involved in the call. In every age, the Holy Spirit calls the church to examine its faithfulness to the story of the triune God. We younger evangelicals in age and or spirit recognize with humble gratitude the worldwide multicultural growth of the evangelical community. Yet at such a time, we need to be especially sensitive to our weaknesses. We believe that today evangelicals fail to achieve full maturity of faith through a commitment to scientific theology on the one hand and a captivity to the cultural narrative or narratives on the other. There is therefore a pressing need to reflect more deeply on the substance of the biblical narrative, its articulation in the historical faith, and its application in the global world. We call the evangelical church to the common faith and practices of ancient Christianity in a time of tumultuous cultural transition and change, similar to that of the ancient church. In this moment between modernity and post-modernity, in a post-Christian and neo-pagan era, we plead for an embrace of God's story and to its implications for an applied theology in the church's missional and global witness. May the church not be formed solely by the world in which it lives, but by the narrative to which it belongs, the story of God. For it is only through God's story proclaimed, enacted, and embodied by God's people that the world will learn its own destiny. We offer this call as a reflection of the new leadership among the younger evangelicals and as a document to facilitate the theological thinking and applied theology of the next generation. We invite like-minded leaders to participate in the preparation of articles for an ancient evangelical future. Without presuming to identify all our needs, we have identified 39 areas of concern and initiatives to set forth an ancient future faith for a global witness in the 21st century. Now, don't turn the page yet because I'm going to make a few comments on the material that I have here, and I'm really only going to make a few comments. What we're trying to do here is to identify the problem. And I think there are two phrases that identify the problem. The problems may be deeper than this, but I think that these two phrases get at the two sides of the issue here that we're concerned about. And those two phrases are, on the one hand, our commitment to a scientific theology, and on the other hand, our commitment to become shaped by the cultural narrative. So you've got these two things that we need to be concerned about. The capitulation to scientific theology and the captivity to a cultural narrative. Now let me comment on both of those. There are some people who have responded to me and said, well, I don't really know what a scientific theology is. Well, essentially, a scientific theology, it's very simple, is a modern theology that is dependent upon the Enlightenment. Now, a scientific theology will take the same framework that we work with in the story, the framework of the triune God, creation, the fall, God's involvement in history, God's incarnation, death, resurrection in Jesus Christ, the church as the witness, and the end times, the eschatological future, the new heavens and the new earth. Everybody works with that framework, which is the story framework. But what a scientific theology does is exactly what postmodernity is against. If you've read Francis Letard in his book titled The Postmodern Condition, he defines postmodernity as the incredulity of the meta-narrative. Now, when I say the triune God, creation, incarnation, recreation, I've expressed the Christian meta-narrative. And so one may say, if post-modernity speaks of the incredulity of the meta-narrative, which would mean all scientific meta-narratives, all rational meta-narratives, all world religion meta-narratives, even an American dream meta-narrative, if he says all meta-narratives are incredulous, does that not mean that we are then falling, collapsing into relativism? Now, the point I want to make about Letard and his incredulity of the meta-narrative is that phrase has been completely misunderstood. The incredulity of the meta-narrative simply means any attempt to prove your meta-narrative is hopeless. Whether your meta-narrative is a Buddhist meta-narrative or whether it's a evolutionary meta-narrative or whether it's a progress meta-narrative or whether it's a Marxist meta-narrative, it can't be proven. You enter that meta-narrative in some kind of predisposition of faith. It's kind of a presuppositional apologetic argument as opposed to an argument that you can prove it to be true. Now, the point about a scientific theology, and I'm sure that all of you have experienced this at some point or another, is that we evangelicals, shaped by the Enlightenment, have said we can prove our story. And what happens when you say you can prove the story is you end up believing the proof, not entering the story. And so the belief of the proof intellectualizes the story, and that's one of the reasons why our worship is in the condition it's in, and one of the reasons why our spirituality is in the condition that it's in, because it has either been intellectualized or experientialized, when the fact is that neither an intellectual understanding of the Christian faith or an experiential understanding of the Christian faith validates the Christian faith. So rather than try to prove the Christian faith to be true, as scientific theology does, we must simply enter into the Christian faith and embody it. That is to live in our baptism, to be a baptized community, to live in the death and the resurrection of Jesus, to live in a cruciform way, to live in an empty grave way, to live in a resurrected way, to live within the context of our baptism into the very death and resurrection of Jesus. So it's an embodied reality rather than an intellectualized or experientialized reality. So I say that when we seek to deconstruct modernity and evangelical reliance on reason, what we're deconstructing is not the story, but the epistemology that argues for the validity, the certification, the truth of the Christian faith on the basis of reason. So that needs to be deconstructed. Now, on the other hand, once you no longer situate your praxis, Christian practice, in God's story, once you divorce Christian practice from God's story, it becomes shaped by the cultural narrative. You see, that's the other problem that we have in evangelicalism. Traditional evangelicalism in the 50s was scientific theology without any practice. I shouldn't say without any practice, but scientific theology that didn't make the connection between theology and practice. And because it didn't make the connection between theology and practice, then pragmatism stepped in. And over the last 30 years, our churches have been shaped by whatever works, whatever is pragmatic. And therefore, we have, in many of our churches, a worship that is primarily narcissistic. Now, I have a song here that I had thought I would play for you, but at some time you'll hear it this week. It's by Rob Still. Rob, are you here? Is Rob here yet? Not here yet. Well, Rob Still sent this to me. He wrote this on my behalf. It's called Bob's Song. And it's the song is, it's all about me, me, me. It's all about me. Can't you see? It's all about me. And I'll have Rob sing it at some point. I did think about putting it up there. And boy, I notice I'm not done with my first point. It's 25 after. So we must deconstruct our reliance on narcissism, consumerism, big business, psychotherapy, all the kinds of things that have shaped the Christian evangelical faith within the last 30 years. So where does that leave us? Well, to go back to this again, it says, we call the evangelical church to the common faith and practices of ancient Christianity. And if you look down a couple lines, we plead for an embrace of God's story. See, Augustine's epistemology, his way of knowing, it's a very famous statement, I believe in order to understand. Whereas the Enlightenment turned it around and said, I understand in order to believe. Perhaps we could say, I embody. I live in the story. I live out of the story. So, for example, just to give you one example, because I don't have time to give much more than that, we confess God to be triune. Now, in the context of confessing God to be triune, we don't mean to say, here's the Father, here's the Son, and here's the Holy Spirit. We have this hierarchical view, and therefore, let's see, I'm the husband of this home, I'm up here, you're the woman, you're down here. And you're the kids, and you're way down here. Or at the Institute for Worship Studies, I'm one of the faculty members, and I'm up here. So you better believe me, I want to be called doctor this or that. And, you know, you're a peon. You know that? The first thing that you need to know about yourself as a student of the Institute for Worship Studies is you're a peon, and we are here to make your life miserable. Our lives were miserable as we went through this stupid doctor's degree. They raked us over the coals. We sweat and, I was going to say swore, but we didn't. Some, maybe Jerry, but not me. And we're going to make it tough for you too. That's a wrong view of the Trinity. The implication of the Trinity is that it's more of a circle. The husband, the wife, the kids are submitting to each other in love. Here at the Institute, the teachers, the students, the staff, we're all on the same plane. We submit to each other in love. We create community because God is the source of community, because God is the eternal community of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who has always lived in the community of love. Now, that's what we call applied theology. The scientific theology would say, hey, I can show you 50 verses where it says the Father is God. Now look at these 50 verses that say Jesus is God. And then there's 50 verses over here that say the Holy Spirit is God. And here's 3 verses that put it together. See? Trinity. And then it just simply becomes an intellectual thing based on some proof texting. But rather we confess in the community of faith, in the communal reading of the triune God, passed down throughout the entire history of the Christian church, that God is a community of love, and that made in the image of God, we are called in our personal relationships with each other, in our families, in our school relationships, in all of our relationships in the church, to live within the context of God's community of love, which is to live out the Trinity rather than to just simply believe that there is a Trinity out there. Well, if you'll turn the page, I must quit. I only have 2 minutes. Read through the 39 articles. If you have any suggestions, they're still in the process of formation. And then if you'll look at the last page, I have given you some books to read. Now, I have to tell you that I looked at this quickly. I just faxed this to in my own handwriting, which people can't read too well, but there are a lot of mistakes in here, and it's caused only by the fact that I'm such a lousy writer, and I thank the people who worked hard to try to figure out my language. It's really pretty close, but you'll see a few mistakes in here, and I take the responsibility for that. But what I wanted to do is to introduce you to some books that you should read. The first one is Myron Penner. I think this is the finest introduction to postmodernity that I've read. Christianity and the Postmodern Turn, it's not six videos, it's six views. So pick this book up and read it. Then there's a new book that's coming out in Baker, James K.A. Smith, Who's Afraid of Postmodernism. The finest book on postmodernity that I've read. Just an excellent, excellent introduction. Wrestling with Derrida, Foucault, and Lyotard. And then if you're interested in working on translating the faith into a postmodern world, which is part of what we try to do here, I really recommend Van Hooser's book. That's not Van Hoorer, but Van Hooser. The Drama of Doctrine. Then I tried to spell it out somewhat in Ancient Future Faith. And then if you don't think this is really representing the ancient church at the bottom, read St. Irenaeus of Lyon on apostolic preaching. The whole thing is story. It starts right with the garden, works through the whole story. And that's the way they did it in the early church. And then if you want to read next to the best sermon that you've ever heard in your life. The best one, you can decide which one. Probably the one we're going to hear tonight. Yeah. You must read on Pascha. This is the most incredible Easter sermon I have ever read in my life. So order those books, read them all. Probably the book that I'm going to ask you to read for the fall, for the summer, I haven't decided completely, but it's titled The Great Giveaway. And the subtitle is Reclaiming the Mission of the Church from Big Business, Parachurch Organizations, Psychotherapy, Consumer Capitalism, and Other Modern Maladies. My kind of book. It's by David Fitch, and David Fitch is one of my colleagues at Northern Seminary, and I'm not asking you to read it because he's one of my colleagues. I'm asking you to read it because it is absolutely phenomenal. It is an incredible book. I wish I could have written it, but it's too deep for me. But at any rate, okay. Was there anything else? Oh, I'm a minute late. The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Go in peace.